Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society, an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars dedicated to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. In addition to this podcast, we publish a journal, Pietas, and host a yearly conference each March. To learn more about us, go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Christopher Annadale, podcast editor for the Society and associate professor of philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University. This special episode of The Sower is a recording of a panel from our 2025 annual conference in Harrisonburg, Virginia. The panel title is Theological Perspectives on the Market, and there are four speakers. First, John Robinson of James Madison University with Scarcity, Isolation, and Dependence, Economic Insight in C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce. Second, Eric Mattson of the Mercatus Center on Economics and Evil. Third, Paul Radich of the Catholic University of America with From the Invisible Hand to the Inexorable Hammer, Cosmological Affinity Between Adam Smith and Karl Marx. Last, Dylan Pommen of the Acton Institute, The Fourth Face of Power, Toward a Pure Theory of Friendship. The last speaker is followed by a 20-minute Q&A period. Due to recording issues, the panel's opening prayer is omitted from this episode. If you like what you hear and want to join our intellectual community, please consider attending our March 2026 annual conference in Omaha, Nebraska. For details, go to ciceroniansociety.org/conference. Here's the panel.
Good morning and welcome to day three of the Ciceronian Society Conference. I'm John Robinson, and I'll be the chair for this panel. The Ciceronian Society has asked me to share a couple of reminders this morning as we begin. If you have not yet picked up your name tag, please do so at the registration desk. No name tag, no food. I think I saw two out there, but I have to presume they're not here. As a reminder, no breakout sessions have assigned discussants. The Ciceronian Society looks to all attendees to support scholars with constructive feedback and encouragement during times of Q&A. That said, please be prepared to ask substantive questions, and for the sake of making conferences great again, please refrain from impromptu speeches. With that, allow me to introduce our panelists, who will each have 15 minutes for their remarks. I'll be the first panelist, and like I said, my name is John Robinson. I'm an assistant professor of intelligence analysis here at James Madison University. I'm an economist by training, and that's still what I do for research. We have also here today Eric Mattson, who's the senior research fellow at the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center. He received his Ph.D. in econ from George Mason, concentrating on the history of economic thought and moral philosophy. His published works explore key thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, including Adam Smith and David Hume, and examine their relevance for modern political economy. Paul Radich is an assistant professor in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America, where he teaches and researches at the intersection of business ethics, virtue, and organizational culture. He holds a PhD in markets and morality from the Catholic University of America. He also contributes to scholarship on Catholic social teaching and its practical applications for contemporary business practice. And lastly, Dylan Pommen is a research fellow at the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty, where he serves as executive editor of the Journal of Markets and Morality. He's a PhD graduate of St. Mary's University, Twickenham, London, on the basis of published works. He is also author of the books Foundations of a Free and Virtuous Society, Acton 2017, and The Kingdom of God and the Common Good, Ancient Faith, forthcoming in 2025. All right, so I'm going to start, and I have a timer on me, but if you don't mind, yeah, thank you. I hope that I'll come in under. So my paper this morning is on Scarcity, Dependence, and the Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. Today, I want to examine one of the fundamental premises in economics, scarcity, through the lens of C.S. Lewis's novel, The Great Divorce. Scarcity, classically defined, describes our predicament as creatures whose desires outstrip the resources available to satisfy them. Or, as Alchin and Allen memorably put it, since the discouraging fiasco in the Garden of Eden, all the world has been a place conspicuous in its scarcity of resources, contributing heavily to an abundance of various sorrows and sins. This economic fact shapes countless decisions in our daily life. We choose how to budget time, money, and energy, precisely because these resources are limited. To an economist like Lionel Robbins, scarcity is so pervasive that he famously defined economics as the science which studies human behavior as a relationship between given ends and scarce means, which have alternative uses. By that reading, in a world in which scarcity disappeared would obviate the very need for economic science. Yet there are strong voices, technologists, futurists, and entrepreneurs, who foresee that scarcity might largely be overcome. Andrew McAfee, for example, points to rising living standards and falling per capita resource consumption in More from Less. Peter Diamandis, in Abundance, imagines solving major global challenges via exponential technologies. Jeremy Rifkin argues in The Zero Marginal Cost Society that digital tools and automation will shrink production costs dramatically. In popular culture, we have shows like Star Trek, depicting replicators conjuring goods at no apparent cost, with no real scarcity in sight. And at first glance, near absolute material abundance seems unambiguously desirable. But in The Great Divorce, Lewis offers a compelling counterpoint, suggesting that a world without scarcity might not be the heaven on earth we expect. In fact, it could be the opposite. My aim this morning is to highlight Lewis's depiction of a post-scarcity environment gone awry, and to illustrate why scarcity, for all of its burdens, might actually nourish genuine community, moral development, and deeper dependence on God. So, scarcity, as I said, is fundamental to economic science. We see it in Robbins' definition. We see it in Karl Menger's definition, talking about valuation and subjective prioritization of goods. We see it in the fundamental concept of opportunity cost, which is at the core of economic science. And many economists, like Malthus or Paul Ehrlich, well, sociologists, warn of scarcity's dire consequences. Others, from Keynes to more modern techno-optimists, argue that we may be on the brink of solving, or at least our absolute needs. So abolishing scarcity to some degree in some important way. Keynes famously forecast economic possibilities for our grandchildren, that within a century or so, technology might render the economic problem marginal, leaving us more time for leisure and cultural pursuits. However, if we follow this line of thought to its end, imagining the outright elimination of scarcity, we encounter some serious questions. Would the disappearance of trade-offs truly produce utopia? This is precisely where Lewis's vision becomes pertinent. In The Great Divorce, Lewis describes a gray town that functions like a post-scarcity environment in some of these essential ways. As the intelligent man, or Ikey, tells the narrator, the trouble is, the inhabitants have no needs. You get everything you want. Not very good quality, of course, just by imagining it. It's kind of a lot like the replicator, although I guess the quality there is maybe higher. So in a place of hunger and want, the ghosts can spontaneously conjure new houses and goods. Yet the gray town is anything but paradise. It is bleak, lonely, sprawling further and farther out as residents move away from one another at the slightest provocation. Ikey observes, that's why it never costs any trouble to move to another street or build another house. In other words, there's no proper economic basis for community life. It's scarcity that enables a society to exist. Now, this is not exactly the most admirable character, so we can't take his word for it, necessarily. But here, no one relies on anyone else. If a neighbor annoys you, you simply build another house down the road. No cost, no worry, no need to coordinate or reconcile. The gray town's emptiness and isolation illustrate that removing scarcity that does not automatically yield real flourishing. Instead, it fosters radical independence and a refusal to engage in the give and take of communal life. Keynes might have hoped that once freed from material want, people would embrace the higher goods of leisure, culture, and fellowship. Lewis paints a different picture. He suggests that when people encounter total autonomy, no real need to cooperate or compromise, they may not turn outward to social or spiritual goods. They might instead indulge in the worst tendencies for self-separation and pride. Lewis's depiction highlights a paradox. For all its inconveniences, scarcity can be a teacher. It compels us to recognize dependence on one another. To Adam Smith, This is the natural propensity to truck, barter, and exchange. We form markets, communities, and institutions precisely because we cannot meet all of our needs alone. In theological terms, this is also about realizing our ultimate dependence on something beyond ourselves. The Great Divorce reflects Lewis's wider emphasis on desire. He suggests that if finite goods were too easy to obtain, we might grow complacent, turning ever inward, ignoring the deeper longing which only God can satisfy. As Lewis puts it elsewhere, nature cannot satisfy the desires she arouses. Scarcity, ironically, draws us outward toward neighbors and upward toward the divine. By lacking real scarcity, the gray town lacks a proper economic basis, meaning no impetus to trade or engage. Without needing a builder's skills or a tailor's expertise, you never have to coordinate. Sorry, been collecting my slides. You never have to coordinate, and there's no genuine community. In a typical scarcity-bound society, we must rely on each other's labor and talents, a situation that fosters relationships, whether communal or commercial. Lewis also recognizes that our desires are not merely the problem economists try to solve. They point beyond themselves, revealing, as in Augustine, a deeper yearning. In The Weight of Glory, Lewis praises the ways diversity leads to exchange and community. Scarcity and difference prompt us to interact, both economically and relationally. St. Catherine of Siena likewise highlights this truth in a famous quote. This is from God. "I have not placed all gifts in one soul in order that men should perforce have material for love of his fellow. I wish that one should have need of the other and that they should be my ministers to administer the graces that they have received from me." Here, St. Catherine affirms that we're purposely made to be incomplete by ourselves. Scarcity and diversity of gifts ensure that we must seek one another out, teaching us to love and to serve. From an economic standpoint, we find parallels to Lewis's perspective in a variety of modern economists' work. Say, Eleanor Ostrom, for instance, who studied common pool resources and the way we cooperate. She showed how communities develop sophisticated cooperative strategies when faced with scarce resources like fisheries or irrigation systems. Scarcity becomes the context in which people learn to collaborate, enforce fair rules, and find solutions that are beneficial to all. In the techno-optimist literature, Diamandis, Kurzweil, Rifkin, and others, there's a common assumption that eliminating scarcity yields immediate gains in human well-being. Undeniably, preventing disease, hunger, and abject poverty is a moral imperative. But the Great Divorce invites us to consider the moral, relational, and spiritual consequences of unlimited autonomy. What if it doesn't bring hearts together, but drives them apart? Lewis's caution then, I hope, is not a Luddite denial of progress. Rather, it's a reminder if our ultimate goal is not just comfort, but community and virtue, we must proceed with humility. We can celebrate each step toward reducing needless suffering while still acknowledging that dependence on each other and on God is an integral part of our shared humanity. So I want to bring these threads together. Economists and futurists commonly see scarcity as a problem to overcome. In many respects, it is. People suffering hunger or preventable disease is tragic. We should applaud every honest endeavor to reduce and eliminate such suffering. Yet, Lewis's Grey Town warns us that wiping away material constraints does not automatically engender love, solidarity, or spiritual insight. A post-scarcity dream might just as easily produce an endless sprawl of isolated individuals, free to never need their neighbors. So here lies the tension. Yes, alleviate scarcity's harms wherever possible. No one should starve or suffer if it can be helped. Yet, recognize that constraints can foster interdependence, moral growth, and genuine community. Ultimately, realize that economic or technological abundance cannot fulfill infinite desire. That longing points to a reality beyond material goods, in which dependence on God and on each other reveals our true identity. As Lewis's Great Divorce illustrates, a society that removes every trade-off might ironically remove some of the most essential bonds that hold us together. And instead of forging heaven on earth, such a world would become the gray town, locked in perpetual isolation. Perhaps we see that today. If we heed Lewis's insight, we may embrace scarcity not as an unqualified, but as a condition that spurs us toward authentic community, mutual responsibility, and deeper relationship with God. In closing, I'd suggest that C.S. Lewis's warnings about a post-scarcity hell challenge us to keep human nature at the center of our economic vision. Economics is at root about people, our relationships, our desires, and our choices. As we push the boundaries of resource efficiency, may we remember that neither abundance nor scarcity alone can secure virtue, love, or salvation. Those must be cultivated through practices and relationships that draw us out of ourselves and into fellowship with one another and with the divine. Thank you. And now, Eric.
The first time I came to the Ciceronian was last year, and Josh Bowman emailed me before the start of the program because I was added late and said, you can use PowerPoint if you like, but just remember that power corrupts, but PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. So I don't have PowerPoint today. My talk is called Economics and Evil, and it relates to John's talk in ways that I didn't anticipate. So economists don't really think about evil, at least as economists, much. My suggestion here today is simply that economic analysis has something to contribute to our understanding of the complexities of evil. Economics, as John well pointed out in his talk, can't solve the problem of evil. And beyond what John said, the notion of bringing heaven down to earth through any kind of set of political and economic reforms is a very dangerous illusion. But nonetheless, economic thought can perhaps offer some partial solutions to some concrete evils that we can identify in the modern world, or at least I think it can help us better identify where evil subsists in the complexities of the modern world. So I want to make a few very modest suggestions along these lines here, and then I'm going to pivot and discuss them a little bit in the context of what I take to be a very interesting episode in the history of 20th century economic thought. So let me start with just a few very broad comments about evil. Evil manifests in or leads to human suffering, and ultimately from a Christian perspective to spiritual death. It's conventionally described in Christian terms as either moral or natural. Moral evil is suffering that's brought about as a direct consequence of malintent. It's caused by deformed desires of the human will. Augustine wrote in his Confessions that the cause of his wickedness, and this is prior to his conversion, in his account, was nothing but wickedness itself. So that's moral evil. On the other hand, we have natural evil, which is suffering and death that seems to come about irrespective of human malintent, and natural disasters are the prime example. But then there's another kind of evil that seems to be a blend of these two types, a blend of the moral and the natural type. This is evil that results from intentional human actions, but not specifically from individual human designs. You could describe theories of this kind of evil as theories of spontaneous disorder. Maybe theologians have a name for this kind of evil, maybe structural evil, I'm not sure, but for now I'll just refer to it as synthetic evil. It's synthetic in that it seems to be somewhere between the natural and the moral. It is a product of human action, so it's moral in that sense, but it's natural in that it's not really the direct result of malintent. So it's a product of the complexities of society, essentially. Economics and complex social analysis provides many, many examples of synthetic evil. Think for a minute about monetary and fiscal policy. These have had wide-ranging and often evil effects, even in recent history. Just strictly in economic terms, you could think about privation, unemployment, social instability, unintended wealth transfers, changing tax incidences, and so forth. There's a very good case to be made, if we go a little back in American history, that the Great Depression was caused and prolonged by entirely misguided monetary policy, combined subsequently with very aggressive but ultimately destabilizing stimulus efforts. These policies, on the whole, were almost certainly not pursued with malintent, but they did lead to a great deal of human suffering. part of the problem here, I suppose, in theological terms, relates to the effects of sin on our ability to comprehend reality. Reality outpaces our ability to know it, including the social and economic orders that we inhabit. Our best efforts are bound to fail along some dimensions because of the corruptions of sin, and because we are on our own powerless to bring heaven down to earth. Now, one way to appreciate some of these epistemic difficulties is to note that reality simultaneously involves entangled combinations of moral, natural, and synthetic evil. The suffering and the death that we observe in the world is a function of all three at once. We are often guilty of malintent, and that leads to our own suffering, and that leads to the suffering of other humans. But even when we're not guilty of malintent, our actions might serve evil ends in non-obvious ways. The road to hell is famously paved with good intentions, after all. And then you have natural evils, which complicate matters even further. So basically, what I would like to suggest very modestly is that economics can help sort some of this out, because economists have consciously developed concepts and theories and bodies of empirical evidence predicated on the decoupling of intentions and consequences. The French economist Frédéric Bastiat, 19th century, taught that economic thinking is about heeding the unseen. So in that trivial sense, economics is actually not so distinct from theology. But economic analysis can partner with theology and the study of politics to help us disentangle the consequences of synthetic and moral evil and take some constructive, if modest, steps towards amelioration through social and political reform. So that's the conceptual piece of the talk. And I want to draw out this, so I could end the talk here, actually, but I want to draw out this suggestion just a bit by discussing it in the context of an interesting episode in the history of 20th century economic thought. And this was an exchange in 1953 between the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr and the economist Kenneth Boulding. It's a very interesting exchange for a number of reasons. I think it provides us a way to think about the effects that theology has on our descriptive economic analysis. But for my purposes, I want to use it to reiterate my basic point that economic analysis can help us partially disentangle evil as we observed in the world, and that ethical and indeed theological analysis should look to economics as a partner discipline, not an inferior. The context of the exchange is a book that Boulding was commissioned to write in 1949 by the National Council of the Churches of Christ. And the title of the book was The Organizational Revolution, A Study in the Ethics of Economic Organization. Essentially, it's a reflection and a moral theological assessment of the second phase of the Industrial Revolution, which picked up maybe in the late 19th century. And then the book includes a critical response to Boulding from Niebuhr, and then Boulding responds to Niebuhr, and their exchange is appended to the book. Boulding advanced four main points in the book. Three pertain mostly to theoretical and empirical questions in economics, and then one pertains to Christian ethics. He argued that the rise in organized labor in the 19th and early 20th century can't be understood just as a response to the alleged exploitations of labor claimed by socialists to have characterized industrialization. He argues that both large-scale industry and large-scale labor collectives emerged in tandem, and they were both expressive of the demands of individuals for influence and power, and they were both made possible by technological developments and by lowered communication costs and transaction costs generally. The second point, he argued that the growth in labor incomes and average living standards throughout the first half of the 20th century are inappropriately assumed to have been brought about by labor collectives. He argues that labor unions undoubtedly contributed in some cases to the welfare of their members in psychological as well as in material terms. But the real welfare gains, he argues, were unequivocally the results of simply economic growth, growth in total factor productivity. Third, he argues that in recognition of the impulse of collectives to pursue the benefits of their members at the expense of non-members, he advocates for the diminishing of political coercion and the rise of multiple contestable sources of power. And then his final thesis is an ethical proposition. He argues that a society governed principally by the voluntary interactions and contracts of individuals approaches the ethical ideal of Christian love. Collective organizations have to be prevented from preserving themselves coercively. The corrupt and dysfunctional organizations have to be allowed to die, for, quote, it is only by constant death and rebirth that loving societies can exist. In this sense, the less existing organizations are protected and the easier it is for them to die, the better the chance of the new birth and the flowering of the loving community. So Niebuhr then responds to all of these points, and he disagrees with all of them. His focus is mostly on the fourth. Before he turns to the ethical proposition, he challenges Bolding on economic grounds with similar arguments that he used earlier to critique the political economy of Adam Smith in an essay and the political economy of F.A. Hayek in a review that he wrote of The Road to Serfdom. The classical liberal, like Bolding, fails for Niebuhr to strive towards what justice requires by neglecting the sources of non-political power. So economically powerful enterprises impede the smooth functioning of society by, quote, appropriating more privileges to themselves than their social functions require. But they are also often guilty of perpetrating injustices. Niebuhr emphasizes very familiar economic arguments about income inequalities, limited labor mobility, and he points to these as indications of power asymmetries that foster different forms of oppression. He argues that these forms of economic power have to be counterbalanced by coercive state action, including the political support for labor collectives, as exemplified by the New Deal, and specifically the programs such as the Wagner Act. He argues, or recognizes rather, that state interventions absolutely create inequalities of their own, but no human organization can possibly be free from corruptions. The outcome of a regulated economy, he argues, irrespective of the details of those regulations, quote, are probably closer to the requirements of justice than those of a completely unregulated economy, because, he continues, they have been established, quote, not by nice calculations of natural law, but by tensions and contests of power, which are a legitimate part of a democratic society. The more interesting part of Niebuhr's response, if at least if you're an economist, lies in his theological argumentation. From a Christian perspective, he claims that one simply cannot make the case that, quote, coercion is in more absolute contradiction to the ideals of Christian love than self-interest. Power and coercion are not, he continues, the simple devils of the drama of man's age-old struggle to gain community. Coercion is pregnant with both good and evil possibilities, exactly as is freedom. Bolding's response to Niebuhr is fascinating. He draws out the theological differences. Niebuhr was a Lutheran, Bolding was a Quaker. Here's what Bolding writes. I may perhaps sum up the difference a little ruthlessly by saying that Professor Niebuhr is afraid of freedom, seeing always behind it the specter of anarchy, whereas I am afraid of justice, seeing always behind it the specter of tyranny. The difference between us is perhaps the difference between the Lutheran vision of God as a mighty fortress and the Quaker vision of God as the living seed. Now, the role of their theological preconceptions is fascinating, and it could provide a useful occasion to discuss the role that theology plays in our descriptive economic analysis itself. And I do think it does play a role in our descriptive economic analysis, but I want to just briefly highlight what Bolding says in his response to Niebuhr about the role of economic analysis in moral theology. Moral theology impels us to serve the good and to ameliorate evil, but he argues that steps toward the good and away from evil and away from suffering in social life cannot be taken without a knowledge of the possible. And this is the domain of social science, he argues, generally, and economics particularly. He puts the point this way: ethical houses cannot be built on economic sand, and the economic myths must be exposed if an adequate ethical structure is to be raised. Niebuhr, Boulding claimed, insufficiently appreciated Boulding's economic arguments, leading him essentially to misapprehend the location of evil in his own argumentation. On the issue of economic power, he points out that Niebuhr overplays his hand, especially in his claims about labor mobility. The broadest argument he makes is that Niebuhr failed to appreciate the market as a regulator of society, not simply a domain of anarchy. Quote, what Professor Niebuhr does not seem to understand about the market is that it is a destroyer, that is, a diffuser of power, not a concentrator. The point here is not simply to say that Boulding was right and Niebuhr was wrong, although I do think that's the case in this instance. The point is to say that the dispute between Boulding and Niebuhr comes down to a dispute about the proper location of what I've described as synthetic evil. Niebuhr perceived that evil to reside essentially in large-scale private enterprises that facilitate or perhaps accelerate the potentials of moral evil or malintent. Boulding, on the other hand, perceived synthetic evil to reside principally in coercive political structures that provide a greater scope for moral evil by presenting incumbent organizations with the temptation to use coercive power to their own advantage. The dispute is not entirely about economics, but economic analysis is vital to sorting it out. Niebuhr's claim that both coercion and freedom are equally pregnant with good and evil possibilities might or might not be correct from a theological perspective. But if he is right, we're still left with the task of sorting out in particular points in history where the balance lies, and the tools of economic analysis can help us with the task. So in a way, my point here that I'm trying to articulate is a simple corollary to the claim that economics can aid ethics and it can aid moral theology by helping us understand how to properly and effectively serve our neighbors and communities. It's also helpful for helping us locate and at least partially alleviate concrete evils. And I think we get a sense of that from the Boulding-Niebuhr exchange. And at any rate, it's a very interesting episode in intellectual history that merits further reflection. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us today. Most of you have this little handout. If you don't, I know as Ciceronians, we admire community. So if you wouldn't mind scooching next to somebody who has a copy or sharing, looking over someone's shoulder. The title of this talk is From the Invisible Hand to the Inexorable Hammer, Cosmological Affinities Between Adam Smith and Karl Marx. It's more obvious and easier to see the dissimilarities, right, between these two figures. But I'm following a technique that Alistair MacIntyre uses oftentimes. I call it widening the frame. MacIntyre's a master of looking at two different opposing viewpoints that everybody assumes are opposing. And he, you know, details it. And then he steps back, and by widening the frame, he points out, actually, these people who think they're disagreeing are standing on the same carpet and share a lot of common assumptions. So I'm kind of using that technique here. A quick precursor, if you look at the top middle there, for the metaphysical background, some things that had changed since Cicero, since Thomas Aquinas, since the Middle Ages, that laid the carpet for modernity for both Smith and Marx. Occam's nominalism, Bacon in the search for laws in natural science, in general, a loss of telos or teleology, a rejection of final causality, a rejection of formal causality, and then ultimately a reductive Newtonianism. So Newton was so successful in his ability to reduce the natural world to a single principle or a few principles. And then that became a model for social science. And both Smith and Marx admired that as well as many others. And so they're trying to make social science more scientific. So as you can see there, the divergences in this Venn diagram, you can see they're numbered 1 through 9. So we'll start with some of the more divergences, and then as we come down lower, we'll see some of the similarities. So they're both classicists insofar as Smith on the left-hand side, he cites Cicero three times in The Wealth of Nations, 16 times in The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And it's interesting, when you look at how he cites Cicero, 10 times it's in a positive, supportive way, two times he's critical, and then a couple other times it's sort of neutral, or he's using Cicero as a source to look at some of the classical references there. What the work that hasn't been done yet, you could be reading Smith, and you could say, wow, that sounds a lot like the Deophikis. And he doesn't cite it, right? Because Cicero's work was something that they were all breathing. And so it would be fascinating if you wanted to use AI or some kind of a statistical large language model to look at the affinities in the actual text. That's for future work. Let me know if you're interested in that. On the right-hand side, Cicero is cited by Marx 22 times in his dissertation. And then Marx also disparages Cicero in his notebooks on Epicurean philosophy. This is what he was using as he was preparing his dissertation. The next one, if you remember Empedocles had this, pre-Socratic had this vision of cycles along, 10,000 year cycles. And there's the battle really between love and strife. And as one goes up, the other goes down over these long periods. And if you think of that background metaphor, they both read Empedocles. On the left-hand side, we could say that Adam Smith is on the side of love, that is, of harmonious relations, and that Marx is definitely on the side of strife. If you look deeper in Marx, you see a Heraclitus sense that there's this inherent conflict in the fabric of the universe. And then you can see he cites Empedocles a number of times as well. In terms of Epicurus, on the left-hand side, Adam Smith disapproves of Epicurus. But on the right-hand side, in his dissertation, as you're reading Marx's dissertation, he's contrasting Epicurus and Democritus on atomism, on natural philosophy. And you follow his logic, and it looks like Democritus is going to win, right? It seems more logical. And all of a sudden, there's this swerve of logic, and Marx sides with Epicurus. And because of the swerve of atoms, and in a sense, many people think it's to preserve freedom. So that's in his dissertation. Number four, obviously they're quite different on private property. Number five, they both have quite a degree of, they look at history seriously, in ways that previous eras did not. For Marx, it's this organic development that he sees order and hierarchy and harmony between the classes, even though there's some envy, that envy is used for economic growth. Obviously, on the right-hand side, Marx sees this class conflict. And when you read Marx, I said earlier that formal and final causality really had been thrown out by this time. And if you're only left with efficient causality and material causality, and then you read Marx and you look at the way he describes history, the material causes, he focuses so much on the material causes, and then the efficient causality of the classes colliding. He uses the word collisions, material collisions in society. So they're using these metaphors of physics into sociology. Obviously, the revolution and the forcible overthrow is very different from Smith. As we come down here, though, there's something that they share with Cicero, the individual good and the common good, trying to see how those two fit together, right? So I'll cite Cicero, and if anyone knows the actual source of this in Socrates, I would love to talk to you later. This is in the De Legibus, Book 1, 33-34, where Cicero claims that Socrates was right when he often cursed the man who first separated utilitas from justice, the private individual good from the common good. For this separation, Socrates complained, is the chief source of the destruction of all. So the separation of the individual and common good. And so the goal was, and you could argue that the entire work of De Officiis is Cicero showing that what appears to be, if there ever is an apparent conflict between the individual and the common, when you look at it properly, they're actually, they coincide. So that he's trying to reunite that. Now, if you look at number six there on the left-hand side, this is a quotation from Theory of Moral Sentiments. The individual actor intends only his own gain, and he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. So this intention is this individual good, and yet he's somehow promoting the common good. That's the Smith's version. On the right-hand side, which was surprising when I found it on 6 prime, on the Marx side, man's private interest must be made to coincide with the interests of humanity. So obviously the way they go about doing that is much different, but they have a common goal, if you will. And number 7 here, so this is something interesting, ataraxia. So all 3 of the post-Aristotelian ancient philosophies of Epicureanism, Stoicism, and Skepticism, they all held that ataraxia, that the tranquility of mind, tranquility of spirit, was a goal of human life, right? And they came across it in different ways and tried to pursue it in different ways. But this is another commonality between Smith and Marx. So if you look on the left-hand side, 7a, so Smith sees this equanimity in the individual at all levels of society. He sought it in his own personal life. He seeks it in poetry. In his commentary on poetry, he's looking at decorum and not over excess in different ways. And then also in science, in terms of order. And that's what the skeptics look at science, because they fear that doubt is, being in error is a lack of equanimity. So they're going to refrain from making judgments when they're not sure. Smith, in terms of using science in a similar way, he also sees it in society, in the hierarchy, in the, you know, the harmony of the system. Now, on the right-hand side, 7 prime there, Marx, he doesn't see it at an individual level. He might hope for it in the future, but he did not find it in his personal life. His personal life was upside down and very tragic. In his own poetry, he is excessive and Mephistophelian and diabolical in many ways to great excess. So he didn't see equanimity there, but he did seek it in science. He did seek this equanimity in science. And finally, and this might be something that for further discussion, this ataraxia is not on the individual level, but because Marx looks at the society as the level of analysis, that's where you see ataraxia. In the final communist end state, right? After all the revolutions and you've killed all the other people that don't agree with you, then that's when you have this ataraxia. So are you keeping track of time?
Sorry. 4.
Perfect, thank you. As we come down now beneath that, we're looking at cosmology or metaphysics. Cosmology can be taken in many different ways, but roughly worldview, our presuppositions about the way the universe works and the way that forces work within the universe. So on the left-hand side with Providence, there are a number of ways that Adam Smith addresses this. And this is in Theory of Moral Sentiments, Book 6. Let's see here. Sorry, let me get the right citation. I'll read this out loud to you, because you almost wonder if Marx could have said something similar, changing a few of the words here. So the wise and virtuous man at all times is willing that his own private interests should be sacrificed to the public interest of his own particular order or society. He is at all times willing, too, that the interest of this order of society should be sacrificed to the greater interest of the state or sovereignty, of which it is only a subordinate part. He should therefore be equally willing that all those inferior interests should be sacrificed to the greater interest of the universe, to the interest of that great society of all sensible and intelligent beings. You hear the background of Cicero and Stoicism in that line, of which God himself is the immediate administrator and director. And he goes on from there. This is in the section on virtue on universal benevolence. And there are other passages that are similar. And so if you just take God out of the picture and you, on the right-hand side, if you look on the right, for number eight there, so Marx doesn't have providence in the divine sense, but he certainly has prediction, or he assumes that the way that history is evolving through this historical dialectic, that it will happen, right? So to have confidence that something's going to happen, you have to have some sense of providere, of seeing forward. So there's this necessity that's driving through the conflict to the future, the time when government won't be necessary. And finally, at the bottom here, this oikiosis, the Stoic principle of appropriation, or of making things like home, you know, making unfamiliar things familiar. On the left-hand side, for Smith, there's this sense of the universal, and this comes up in many different ways. The impartial spectator is one version. Decorum, of what other people would see and appreciate. You can see that from Cicero in Smith. And then on the right-hand side, Marx uses it a little bit differently in terms of the universal. He talks about the human being as a species being, and he draws some of that from Feuerbach. But ultimately, he divinizes the working man and the homo faber. So we started with MacIntyre, and I'll end with MacIntyre slightly here. Just an observation MacIntyre made. He said that at times when empire is on the rise and individual or the polis is on the decline, he said at those times in history, that's when Stoicism is also becoming more popular. So if you look at the Alexander the Great and with the end of the city-states as they were known in Greece, that's when Stoicism started to rise, the sense that you're more passive and you go along with what the universe is telling you. And you see that a little bit in Adam Smith as well, in terms of the political sense at the time, and with the rise of the British Empire and the decline of Scottish sovereignty, and also in Marx, he was really a man of no country, right? Evicted from, sent out of Germany, sent out of France, ends up in England. So he had to be, you know, in many countries. Is that a good time? All right, I look forward to your comments afterwards. Thank you.
All right. So my paper, like Eric's, also builds on Kenneth Boulding. It's about friendship as a social system. The work of economists, peace activists, and general systems theorists, and Quaker poet, Kenneth Boulding, remains unjustly obscure today. With only a handful of exceptions, few scholars have engaged with his life and work since his death in 1993. Yet in his own time, he and his work were well regarded. He was the second ever winner of the John Bates Clark Medal in 1949, and he was nominated for both the Nobel Peace Prize and the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. In our siloed academy today, we could all benefit from revisiting Boulding's work in our own time and building upon the foundation he set for a systematic understanding of social life and social science. This paper contributes to that end by outlining a pure theory of friendship as both social system and social dynamic, understood in Boulding's terms, to be detailed below. As I go. So from a theological point of view, there's actually a few old Christian maps, but I'm just going to talk about this one for now. If you look at like the catechetical literature, basically 16th through 18th or 19th century, especially the command to honor your father and mother, usually goes into other authorities you need to honor and obey as well. And it will talk about state, the magistrate, state authorities, and the church. And this kind of develops into in the work of, say, F.P. Morris. He has these as kind of levels of society. You have the universal, the national, the local. Then, of course, each gets expressed in the lower orders as well. So you have national churches, you have local parishes, and so on. And this worked until about the Second Industrial Revolution. And then you get thinkers really seeing that it's become inadequate. So they start adding things like work or culture or economy as like a fourth estate. So people like Hermann Bobbing, Dietrich Bonhoeffer does that, Vladimir Solovyov in my own tradition. Also there are people who just talk about an array of unnumbered social spheres. Abraham Kuyper is the most well-known. Before him, the Lutheran Hans Lassen Martinsen, Bishop of Zealand, Danish theologian, did it as well. And Kuiper read his work. I've written about that. And then on the development of social science and economics, you get a very different scheme, which is still relevant and talked about today, and is what I think Bolding contributes to, and I'm going to add to. And that is Adam Smith talks about beneficent society, the state, and commerce. Or today, we would say civil society, the state, and the market, right? And there have been some theologians who have engaged with this as well. So Michael Novak would be a good example. His kind of three-legged stool is exactly that. And Brent Waters, who's here, I don't know if he's here in this room, but he's here at this conference. So say hi to him, read his work. He's great. In an article last year, I, using Bolding, built on it as well from an Eastern Orthodox point of view in faith and economics. So take a look at that as well. But unfortunately, what typically happens, most political and economic commentators today simply talk about market and state. I'm trying to find a quote from Benedict XVI. Here it is. As Pope Benedict XVI noted, the exclusively binary model of market plus state is corrosive of society, while economic forms based on solidarity, which find their natural home in civil society without being restricted to it, build up society. The market of gratuitousness does not exist, and attitudes of gratuitousness cannot be established by law. Yet both the market and politics need individuals who are open to reciprocal gift. And so Bolding's work, most clearly in his Three Faces of Power, sought to give a clear conceptual background to the three social spaces of state, market, and civil society in the form of threat systems, exchange systems, and integrative systems. But Benedict's social space of reciprocal gift doesn't fit so easily into these three categories. He includes it in civil society, but without being restricted to it, speaking of economic forms based on solidarity. So how can we make sense of this? My answer is friendship. So I'm going to get into that, but I'm going to start with Bolding. So here is just kind of one of several different ways in which Bolding explains it. So you have, he talks about this in terms of power and the most simple form of the ability to get what I want. Threat power happens when A says to B, give me that good thing or I'm going to do this bad thing to you. That might sound bad, but law is a threat system. We need good laws. We need the rule of law in any flourishing society. And this is just a necessary element of power in all social life. Exchange happens when someone A says to B, I'll give you this good thing if you give me that good thing, right? This is the logic of markets. Economists will recognize that. And then integrative power is like the power that children have over their parents. We could say it's that love compels parents to provide for their children, expecting nothing in return, right? He talks about these. I think this is coherent, and it clearly maps on to that kind of state, market, civil society dimension and division. We should note, and as is documented here, that he actually conceives of these as fuzzy sets. So these are dynamics. He talks about them as systems. So a threat system would be like the state, an integrative system would be the family, and an exchange system would be a market, right? Those are just examples of many others. But he calls them fuzzy sets. So they all contain dynamics of the others. That's why they're not just, threat systems are not just destructive power, right? Law needs legitimacy, integration, and some self-interested benefit, exchange. So we speak of a social contract. We want our taxpayer dollars to be well spent, right? There's an exchange dynamic, even in politics. It's not a bad thing, necessarily. markets need contracts, threat, and trust, integration. And any parents will tell you that while they want their children to obey them out of love, sometimes kids must be motivated by rewards, exchange, and punishments, threats as well. Bolding grouped threat systems and integrative systems into a broader category he called the grants economy. He did this because he wanted his fellow economists to stop only looking at the exchange economy. Unlike markets, economically speaking, these involve one-way grants. However, these systems differ along a different dimension. So threat systems are neither impersonal or impartial, are necessarily impersonal or impartial, as required by the rule of law, while integrative systems are necessarily personal. Yet Boulding does not apply a similar distinction to the exchange economy. He does not systematically differentiate between personal market systems from impersonal markets. Indeed, in general, not to overgeneralize, but economists tend to view markets as fundamentally impersonal social spaces. But markets only gradually grew into their own realm of impersonal relations. And many traditionally minded philosophers and theologians might object that at least some personal relations are economically productive. Boulding's schema advances upon the common distinctions of market, state, and civil society, but it still struggles to comprehensively map our social life. We need a fourth face of power. We need friendship. So what is friendship? Friendship has been a sometime commonplace of philosophy and theology, at least since the time of Aristotle, contributions of which will be surveyed as I go along here. This literature, however, sometimes is dismissed as too idealized by sociologists. And since of all the social sciences, sociology would seem to be the most natural to study friendship, we need to incorporate that literature as well. The difference can be generalized as follows. Philosophers and theologians tend toward too idealized or even singular definitions of friendship, whereas sociologists verge dangerously close to losing the forest for the trees, as the saying goes, emphasizing the variety of friendships to the point of muddying the concept in its most basic form. We need a general, universally applicable definition of friendship, even if real people would not call all such relations by the label friends, in order to only then examine subcategories. Herein, I propose to define friendship as any personal and positive sum relations. As a corollary, while relationships of charity or authority are hierarchical, relationships of exchange are more egalitarian. Thus, friendship is any personal positive sum egalitarian relation. So too, because it is an egalitarian positive sum relation, it is also fundamentally, even if not wholly, voluntary. If taken together, this dynamic is the core of any particular relations, those relations constitute friendship systems. If instead it is only an aspect of a relation, then it is a friendship dynamic of in a threat, integrative, or exchange system. And that's my thesis. So consider an example. One might think of the Popeye character Wimpy, known for the catchphrase, "I'll pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today." That sort of proposition cannot possibly work in impersonal markets like McDonald's. But if one happens to know a restaurant owner personally, and on the basis of one's friendship, he or she knows that one will indeed pay Tuesday for a hamburger today, the proposition is reasonable. We may say friendship is the Wimpy dynamic, where an exchange is not a matter of contract, but, to quote Benedict 16 once again, reciprocal gift. At least some sociological literature has identified this egalitarian exchange dynamic as fundamental to friendship as well. To his credit, Boulding noticed this dynamic, but he limited it to two-person relations, rather than extending it to the level of social systems. By contrast, C.S. Lewis distinguished friendship from romance in part by its ability to expand beyond two-person relations. Eros, he says, is necessarily between two only, but two, far from being the necessary number for friendship, is not even the best. The existence of friendship groups and networks raises the possibility of friendship systems. Good economists, to be fair, will recognize this kind of exchange in the sphere of informal markets. Though often carrying the negative connotation of black markets, many entrepreneurial endeavors also begin in this realm, exchanging favors between friends before growing to the point of becoming viable businesses in the formal market. Alternatively, mutual aid societies, social clubs, and even religious brotherhoods and sisterhoods could be examples of institutions that primarily exist in the friendship realm, right? Moreover, these informal exchanges should be understood in terms of reciprocal gift. Not all of them are simply the market without the law. Many take the form of giving a favor now, receiving one later, and not really keeping count unless the favors become so one-sided as to strain the egalitarian nature of the relationship. That said, just as with other social systems, as a fuzzy set, friendship systems contain dynamics of the others. Voluntary associations still need rules. Some even have charters and bylaws. It's a threat system, or threat dynamic, I should say. So too, at a more informal level, Father Pavel Ferensky talked about mutual obedience between friends, this kind of monastic aspect of friendship. As for exchange, while the mutual benefits may be more than immediate and more than economic, nevertheless, members often pay dues, and meetings often require registration fees, as we all know. That said, such associations can confer honors and awards upon members or even non-members above and beyond the positive sum benefit of the ordinary member receives. So that's an integrative dynamic of these organizations. And similarly, members may be called to extra volunteer service, such as serving on a board or as a trustee and so on. But do the other social systems contain friendship dynamics? Indeed, they do. While it is a corruption of governments in economies to construe them as entirely about exchanging favors, cronyism, nevertheless, personal positive sum relations do play an important political role. Character witnesses and trials might be an example. Letters to one's congressperson who will help her constituents with the hope of earning their votes might be another. In exchange systems, as already noted, startups lean heavily on friendships. In addition, when applying for any job, applicants are regularly required to list references and is typically frowned upon to list family relations for this purpose. Indeed, the phenomenon of networking in general would seem to fit this dynamic. Moreover, all businesses benefit from and to some degree depend on word of mouth advertising between friends. Last, though Boulding only conceives of friendship in terms of two-person relations, he does mention that with the rise of feminism, for better and worse, spousal relations have taken on more friendship dynamics than in past eras. We can also talk about adult children, and I think even adult siblings should have something of this dynamic. So what do we get out of this? This is what we get out of this. I wish that were bigger, but I'll explain it. Instead of two economies, the grants economy and the exchange economy, we now have four. Grants, exchange, personal, and impersonal. In moral terms, personal relations are governed by mercy, whereas impersonal relations must uphold impartial justice. Having established the nature of friendship as a social system and dynamic, we can now examine its origins, varieties, applications, interactions with other social systems, and dissolution. So I'll come back to this at the conclusion, but feel free to ask me for it, and I'll send it to you. And then I'm going to kind of summarize so I don't take too much of your time. All right, origin, homophily. This is the sociological term for liking the same thing, basically. So C.S. Lewis says the typical expression of opening friendship would be something like, "What? You too? I thought I was the only one." Or as John Cusack said in Almost Famous, he's actually speaking of romance, but it works. Books, records, films, these things matter. Call me shallow. It's the effing truth. So there's the commonality goes beyond common interests. In fact, friendships tend to be, you know, along the lines of race, gender, social class. But what tends to transcend that is things like common interests, experience, activity. I wouldn't call this the nature of friendship, but I do think it is an essential aspect, at least, of the origins of friendship. And I'm just going to skip ahead. Varieties of friendship. We speak of work friends, school friends, church friends, club or hobby-related friends. There's all kinds of different friends, right? Aristotle, as LaRose and Storr note, distinguished between three moral levels of friendship: utility, pleasure, and virtue. Cicero similarly distinguished between the highest form of friendship based on virtue and all others. And he has a good quote, which I skipped earlier, but he talks about how if you take goodwill away from kindred, you're still your brother, right? If you take it away from friendship, you don't have a friendship anymore, right? So there's just a fundamental difference between relations of family and relation of friends, and yet we always group them together when we talk about civil society. William K. Rollins, a sociologist, adds another Aristotelian distinction, that between true friendship and civic or political friendship, the latter of which being characterized by goodwill and pursuing a common good. William B. Rubin examines the phenomenon of best friends. Many scholars had noted the existence of long-distance friendships, and we could even talk about imaginary friends, not just in the little kid sense, but, you know, people talk about, oh, yeah, Bob and I are friends. When's the last time you saw Bob? Well, I don't know, 10 years ago, you know. I mean, it happens all the time, right? And so my point is simply there's a variety of friendships. We should expect there to be a variety of friendship systems. Applications. How much time do I have? How are we doing? 1 minute. Okay. All right. So Lewis talks about how friendship is kind of an affront to authority unintentionally, or at least authority is suspicious of it. Keep in mind in that chart, it's literally the opposite quadrant to threat systems, right? So we should expect the most amount of tension between these dynamics. Clement of Alexandria, really great quote, talks about kind of the social, the poverty relief aspect of friendship, which I think is really important today. No one becomes homeless who has family and friends to fall back on, right? And he says, if I can find the quote, Speaking of Christ's teaching to make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, the Lord did not say give or bring or do good or help, but make a friend. But a friend proved himself not by one gift, but by long intimacy. So most modern poverty in the developed world is network poverty. It's not just people needing stuff. All right. Friendship and other social systems. I don't have time to get into this, but we can talk about how peace is formed. Bolding did a lot of peace studies. Then he talked about integrative response to threat can be peace. But that's if we allow for friendship, there should be two kinds of peace. So after the Revolutionary War, you got the United States, you got Britain, but we're allies today. We're friends. After the Civil War, no more South. I mean, there's a South, but it's not, no more Confederacy. It was reintegrated. And even though there are rumors the South will rise again, most Southerners still participate in our federal, you know, government, right? They vote, they run for federal office, that sort of thing. They've been reintegrated. And then we can talk about the European Union as this complicated mix and so on. And then I think I'm close to my conclusion. Okay, one more little section. Dissolution. I have three categories. There might be more. Estrangement, betrayal, and death, which on the level of social systems, friendship systems, we could talk about becoming defunct, mission creep, and disbanding. And Lewis is this identity aspect of friendship. Lewis talks about when a friend dies, you lose the part of your other friends that only came about with that friend, right? The part of yourself that was only, you know, so there's people feel that way about organizations that, oh man, I really wish that was still around. We had the greatest meetings and, you know, all that kind of stuff, or the work we did together was so great. Very, very similar. So let's get to the conclusion. I'll put the chart back up there. And I'll read this and I'll be done. Sorry to go a little over. Our social analysis must account for friendship systems and dynamics. While theological approaches to social theory have historically struggled to account for modern economies, economists too often struggle with economism, viewing every social system as ultimately an exchange. Bolding's work helpfully highlights that the exchange economy exists alongside the grants economy of threat and integrative systems. This paper, moreover, has shown how broadening Bolding's social schema to include friendship as a fourth face of power, a social dynamic within four economies and four systems, as illustrated here, and constitutive of its own, provides a more analytically complete social map. This interdisciplinary approach also contributes to the sociological literature, inasmuch as sociology requires a generally applicable definition in order to ground the varieties of subcategories examined in empirical studies. Future research across the humanities and social sciences should analyze these varieties of friendship systems, their relation to other systems, and the friendship dynamics embedded within every system and sphere of social life. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here. We have about 20 minutes for questions, and we'll get started.
It's a simple question. Judas, for you, so did you start to read Bolding? You mentioned the organizational revolution. When you start to read Bolding, where would you start?
My answer is Three Faces of Power. I think that it's a really succinct, tight explanation of the stuff I've been talking about. Unfortunately, it's out of print. Maybe an easier way to go is actually go to JSTOR or EconLit or whatever. Find some of his articles. He wrote a ton of articles. You can get a lot of the ideas in a pretty condensed form there. So he has an article on theory of threat systems, which is kind of good. Or, you know, I think there's one up around the grant economy. Yeah, another one that can get you there. But I don't know if there's any.
I would recommend his presidential address when he was president of the American Economic Association. It's not long. It's called Economics as a Moral Science.
Yeah.
Michael?
This question is for you, John. So I loved your presentation, especially just the comment. There's just lots of things and it's delighted about the presentation. And the question about relevance. So I start my first review clients at the Star Trek later, even though nobody knows what Star Trek is. So I have an exponent. But it's this post-scarcity framework that I start with, because then I explain to them that the real scarcity is the time.
Yes.
So I'm just curious if you've thought about this or where we, you know, by thinking about time and how we allocate our time to be the ultimate decision of scarcity. And maybe you said it for Lewis and what's going on there. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I don't in the paper right now extend it to time. And time is also one of the places I go when I used to teach those classes. Yeah. So that's a great thought. And I'll think about it, because I suspect I could find something in Lewis. I've been going back through my library. It's been a few years since I've really spent a lot of time with Lewis. And so I'll keep that in mind as I do.
I think it actually accords with your thesis that in the gray city, time is not scarce.
Right.
I think it would fit right in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robbins also talks about scarcity of time.
Okay.
In his definition, you can have got it explaining.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. That's great. Yeah.
Thank you. Paul, I very much appreciate your project of finding commonalities between Smith and Marx, because I think that Marx, in short, would have seen Smith as adequate to his time, the time of the bourgeois revolution, as distinct from the industrial revolution. Two additional commonalities find out both political. One, they were both critics of the pilot, critic Thomas Smith, the East India Company was distorting British politics and the intervention period. And Smith and Marx, vis-a-vis Napoleon III, and what was widely at that time critiqued, including by Romans, as Napoleon III Caesarism, or Bonapartism, a Marx. And Marx sees a repetition of this in Bismarck, unconscious of matters of self-evident, Napoleon III. And essentially, Marx thought that under capitalism, you're going to get the Wilsonian administrator state, you're going to get the New Deal. This is how capitalism will need to be politically managed. And he's critiquing that in a kind of primordial form in his criticism of Napoleon III. And I think the second political compound would be the role of full employment. But Smith thinks that this will happen as an extension of bourgeois social relations with the passing away of feudalism, aristocracy, serfdom, peasantry, and even slavery, sort of naturally in society. Right? For Smith, the revolution is in society. But Marx is indicating, he's really writing to the workers' movement, which is taking up Smith's ideas. Workers who want to find and reclaim their value, the value of their labor power. And Marx is essentially saying that after the introduction of labor-saving technology, you can no longer proceed on the stem Smithian program, right? The bourgeois revolution is entered into a solid contradiction. And to reach that goal of workers actually recovering property and their labor power, you're going to need to take on the socialist mentality. You can't just sort of proceed individually prosecuting the bourgeois revolution, living by labor. You know, the Emancipation Clause Act of 1776 is no longer adequate to 1848 and minutes after that. But I think those two political goals, you know, essentially full employment and also the critique of the empire, would also be used.
Thank you very much.
So, Eric, I have a kind of question for you. So, thinking about evil, the way you talk about it, I guess I'm puzzled a little bit, or I'm trying to think through, you know, what you're doing, think about like the New Testament, where especially like the natural evil, right? So obviously suffering is not some kind of inherent good, but the New Testament speaks actually very positively of certain kinds of suffering, right? As towards sanctification, as for redemptive. And we also see patterns of suffering then leading to greater glory or to restoration later. So, you know, like Joseph is, you know, a quintessential example of, you know, evil happening to him, but good resulting because of God's work. And so I guess what I'm wondering is how do you think about, like, when your talks are about the synthetic evil, right? It's almost the flip of spontaneous order, right? Like a positive spontaneous order, so to talk about. It's like when you have like spontaneous disorder. How do you think about like measuring the problem of that evil, or the role of, is really evil primarily about suffering? Because the example you gave seemed to be primarily about suffering, and it doesn't seem to me that suffering in and of itself is an unmixed evil.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, suffering is not a good in and of itself,
right?
But it can lead to good ends. And this, of course, relates to the problem of theodicy, theologians trying to grapple with the existence of evil in light of God's omnipotence and his goodness. And there is a evil does lead to good ends. You see that throughout scripture. It's interesting that a lot of early political economists were engaged with this question of theodicy. There's a pretty sizable literature that argues that actually early classical economic theories were actually exercised in theodicy. So there's an argument that Hutcheson's theories were an elaboration of the theodicy. Smith's Wealth of Nations actually has been described as an Augustinian theodicy. For your question about measurements, I don't try to measure.
Maybe to modify my question slightly, is I guess the question I have, and this is sort of like a parenting thing as well, how much and when should our focus be on getting rid of the suffering versus how much should that focus be on redeeming the suffering, right? So for example, our natural impulse, say with a child who's made poor decisions, is okay, how can I relieve the suffering? And sometimes that's right, but sometimes it's actually, okay, how do we make this a learning experience? Like, how do we help the child move through the suffering? Like, our job is not necessarily just to end the suffering, but to redeem it, to reframe it, to help those come through it. And that's kind of what I think I'm getting at here, where I think economists are generally, from a material standpoint, right, for budget constraints and your resources, like, so it's almost all about removing the suffering. And certainly that has an important place. And, you know, John, you're for this as well. But I guess I'm kind of thinking through how do we nuance that, or is there more depth here in terms of how economics can help us think about evil, particularly suffering from systems and unintended consequences?
Well, I don't know that economics can help us understand what suffering is fundamentally. And to answer your question, I'd have to think more carefully about what I mean by suffering. If you want to think about it in terms of work, you might think about the distinction between labor and toil. Labor as work or struggle towards an end, a redemptive end, a purpose. The toil is doing drudgery for drudgery's sake.
Indeed.
That would be one thing I have to think about.
Okay.
So a couple of hands. So we'll take a couple of quick ones then. One, two, and then three.
Yeah, just jump on that last discussion or the suggestion / you know, how one of us might resolve the question. It sounded like in the paper, maybe perhaps the definition of evil was just suffering, but I was thinking, wouldn't it be more traditional for you to say evil is that which produces suffering in a properly functioning even? But if we're not properly functioning, something that's evil might actually produce pleasure in us.
The traditional view of evil, at least if you go back to Augustine, is the privation theory, which is right. Was the absence of good. And the absence of good leads to deformity and suffering and the path to death. So that kind of suffering, I mean, insofar as it's the problem, the absence of good is being not good, but then there's peace.
I barely persuaded that relieving suffering, relieving scarcity can reduce community. What are the conditions of abundance that would conduce to community rather than useless destruction?
I think broadly speaking, we can think of abundance and the reduction of scarcity as generally tending toward the good. And in fact, it's the result of it can often be the result of communal activity. And so I wouldn't want to suggest that abundance itself is a problem. But I think from Lewis, at least, this perspective is a helpful corrective just from over-exuberance. And that's, so my point is, I think, fairly modest in that I don't want to suggest that Lewis or the rest of us ought to be afraid of the reduction of scarcity or overcoming types of scarcity. I think broadly and generally it is a good thing. It's not utopian in and of itself. And so it should be measured against or only as a secondary good to the community which produces it in many cases.
Thank you all for the panel. The papers are really good and a lot of good thought-provoking questions. Can an evil person have friendship?
I actually talked about this as morally neutral. I think we should talk about morally ideal forms of friendship, but I didn't have time to get into it, but you know, the different sort of organizational constructions of friendship, like cronyism is bad, but it's a friendship dynamic corrupting the economy and the state, right? Nefarious conspiracies involve friendship dynamics between the conspirators, right? So yes, I would say, you know, if you want to emphasize that, well, true friendship is moral and virtuous, like Aristotle or Cicero, well, then yes, of course, no, an evil person can't be virtuous. You know, that's a contradiction. But if we're just talking about a social phenomenon, which may have, you know, good and flourishing forms, but it may also be corrupted, as evil is a corruption of the good, then yes, I think so.
If I could comment on the question I was asked John just a minute ago, I think this is why traditional Christian practices and Christian communities involve self-discipline, right? Mm-hmm. This say norms and practices are actually practices in abundance of setting constraints upon ourselves, right? So, right, there's a difference between fasting because you don't have food and fasting when you do have access to food.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's kind of practice. So a lot of, you know, Christian walk and a lot of communal activities and norms and traditions are actually about sort of self-limitation in the face of abundance for pursuing other kinds of goods. And I think that actually, it creates a kind of scarcity, right? It's sort of a chosen scarcity for some other kind of end. So it's not like you don't have food. It's rather choosing to forego it for some other reason. So scarcity still plays a role. There's meaningfulness to that because the scarcity provides a certain kind of actually suffering or other kinds of meaning. Anyway, so there's a lot involved there, but that's, I think, how we should think about dealing in an ever more abundant society and why it's important not to have just an exercise of will or expressive individualism where we're just trying to do what we want all the time and cast off constraints, because then you lead into the gray city when there are no constraints on what you
want. Right. Well, and I think there too that the point is, or the point I'm hoping to make in the paper is not that abundance can't lead to or can't be a big part of communal activity. And in many cases, it may be that in order to use abundance well, human practices and human communities must implement an artificial sort of scarcity to counteract other vices.
Right.
And I think one of the major disagreements between the vision that Keynes offers in his essay and the vision that Lewis offers in the Great Divorce is really that it comes down to questions about your human nature or human tendencies, perhaps more modestly, just that yes, in principle, with all of the material abundance we have around us, we could all be doing so much good for one another. And yet what we see is a great deal of isolation. It's one of the problems of our time is that we have the luxury to isolate ourselves. And so we've done precisely what Lewis warns about in The Great Divorce, not by building homes, but by building our own mental castles where, you know, we're consuming alone. And I think it's sort of shocking, but maybe not shocking at all.
Quick question relating to that too, for an excellent presentation is reminding me that it was at the most run Great Divorce. I wanted to ask you if you had thoughts in the paper or whatnot on something that I don't think you directly addressed it, which is, as I understand kind of the baby version of your argument, it's essentially scarcity has a good side because it's an incentive to community, which raises interesting questions about whether there might be scarcity moving in the resurrection that's useful in that direction. But I think also what the argument I was expecting to hear was sort of a Burkean post-scarcity is power. It's the ability to get what you want. But power is only as good as the person who's being in power. And Christian angle, obviously, that can wrestle with original sin from a materialist angle. You might talk about evolutionary tendencies that are problematic. And so you address them in the papers with the question of even not even necessarily dealing with the art of positive argument for community, but rather the terrible things that it might do given what we all. But one of the arguments that historians think about why the sexual revolution comes about is simply the economy's living.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't in the paper actually go in that direction. And it's certainly worth thinking about. The direction I go more is related to your first point about the role or the place of scarcity in heaven or in the resurrection. And actually there I talk briefly about a distinction that Jordan Ballard made recently, that when economists talk about scarcity, perhaps what they're really talking about it from in theological terms, it would be finitude. And then I appeal to Catherine McCullough's work on dependence and a Catholic anthropology. So I don't know that it would be right in economic terms or to talk about scarcity in heaven, but we certainly talk about our finitude even in heaven, and so our continual dependence on God. And that, so it is a, our limitedness, our finitude is a, is an, is a necessary part of our existence. So the attempt to overcome it here is not only inevitably doomed to failure in theological terms, but in economic terms along the way, maybe moving in a direction that is not necessarily always good. So that's the direction I take it.
Just one quick comment about this discussion and the previous discussion. One thing that might help in terms of scarcity and the future, if we distinguish between goods that are particular to one person, individual goods versus common goods, because I think that you could have a superabundance of particular goods, you know, individual physical goods, and a you know, a poverty of common goods, as in the great city. Whereas you could also use, like this conference, for example, is a common good, that insofar as we, you know, in participating in it, the more people that participate, it doesn't detract from the good that others experience, but maybe would add to it. So there's a communal sense of good, I think, that maybe could help.
Yeah.
With that.
It also makes me think that there's discussion of community in with respect to the gray city and sort of the lack of community. I need to go back again to the Great Divorce, but there's not, you know, each and every one of the stories that happens in the latter half of the book seems to play out, I mean, primarily within the individual soul. But I wonder if I'm missing anything there. We have a few more minutes for questions, please. I saw your hand first. One, two.
Seems like your spiritual dimensions to friendship that wouldn't be susceptible to economic analysis. What does economic contribute to the understanding of friendship?
So what it contributes is the idea that it's economically productive, that it's economically significant. Really, this is more a contribution that I'm trying to contribute to economics. Coming my background is theology. And I didn't really get into it, but I do think there are, of course, spiritual theological. I mentioned Father Thomas Morency, his whole chapter in his book, Filling Ground with Truth, is all about kind of the spiritual nature of friendship. And S.L. Frank as well, it talks about subornost, and it's more kind of that personal economy when he's talking about personal dynamics. So I don't mean to discount that at all, but I'm trying, in this paper, I'm trying to do something a little more social sciencey in that I want to help develop a general category of analysis that can be useful, whether it be social theorists who are in the humanities, philosophy, theology, you know, other sorts of ethics, morality, or social science, or sociology, or economics. So I'm trying to do this kind of theory, more general sort of thing that hopefully other people can add their more discipline-specific contributions to. So yeah, good questions.
This question is for Eric. With the rise of trends like conscious consumerism, ESG investing, and others in recent years, there seems to be a trend towards saying that outcomes that we might previously have thought of as synthetic evils are actually the result of malintent on the part of individual actors, because these actors are not engaging in rigorous enough decision making. And so I just wondered if the downside of fighting synthetic evil with state action is tyranny, and if the downside of fighting it with market forces is anarchy, what might be the downside of attempting to fight it with what you might call hyper, applying an extreme degree of decision-making rigor to individuals?
Sorry, can you repeat the last part? So I get the question about tyranny versus anarchy. And what's the third?
Well, I just wondered that if you look at that as a potential third option, we're told that actually the way to fight synthetic evil is that each individual actor should be imposing an exceptionally high standard of analysis or evaluation to their decisions, that they should be taking into account every possible ramification of the product that they buy or the investment that they make. Do you see there being a drawback to, a distinctive drawback to that as a potential third option?
I think I understand. So you're asked, basically suppose someone takes what I say seriously and thinks, I need to think very carefully about the non-obvious evils that my actions might cause. Is there a downside to that? Is that your question?
Yes, I just thought that if you look at these trends and say, well, it seems that maybe you're being told that this is actually how we should be trying to fight synthetic evil, what are the potential drawbacks to that?
Yeah, well, I think the easiest answer is to say that those claims are predicated upon certain social and economic theories, and we can interrogate those theories with the tools of social, political, and economic analysis. I think that's the short answer. I think conscientiousness is unavoidable. I think that it's good per se, but I think there's a lot of opportunism and predation in modern conscientiousness movements. Talk to Paul about this. He writes a lot about ESG. So there are downsides, of course. I mean, the point of my talk is not to say that, well, once we start thinking about social and economic theory, we can solve the problems. It's just saying that when we think about the problems of evil and the problems of the complexities of our world, the tools of economic analysis in particular can be helpful. Of course, economists disagree about lots of things, so it's not a silver bullet. And there are always downsides and non-obvious results of all theories and actions. The point was just to say very modestly that I think social and economic analysis can be very helpful, even in analyzing things like the ESG movement.
Thank you. And thanks again to my fellow panelists.
Thank you for being here.
You have been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share it with a friend. We hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter or joining us for a future in-person event. For details, go to ciceronianssociety.org.